Alrighty, everybody. Welcome back to Cibolo Creek Conversations. My name is Wyatt Marchant. I realized I didn't do the intro correct last time. Mr. Paul Wilson, who is also here.
Are we even recording?
We are. We've been recording this whole time. I get to cut out a lot.
Man, we just had a long conversation. I was waiting for you to push the button.
Nope, already pushed them. But nobody else gets to see what those conversations are.
Exactly. So you didn't do it typically?
No, last time, I guess you were worried about like being out of practice. I didn't even introduce myself last time.
Well, there you go. Yeah. You should take a moment and introduce yourself.
I can cut this and put it in last time's. I'm Wyatt Marchant.
Marchant. Yes.
Yes. The.
So we call this Cibolo Creek Conversations.
We do.
And today is sort of like the epitome.
Yep. Because I didn't give you any notes.
Because you gave me a topic and no questions, no preface.
Nope.
We are simply taking this as it unfolds.
You know,
it should be interesting.
I don't know if you remember this, but towards the end of last season, whatever you want to call the seasons, before we took a break.
Season sounds great.
Yeah, season sounds fine. Before we took a break, the breaks are just undefined of how long they are. I was mainly doing just a topic, and you actually became, like, you actually got to the point to where you liked that more because the conversation flowed better.
Yeah. No, so. I'm fine with it. It's just like typically you'll send me an email with the topic and a couple of questions that you're going to ask me. But I haven't seen anything other than you greeting me on Sunday morning saying, I think this week we'll talk about, and then you told me what the topic
was. That was yesterday. That was at our staff meeting.
Oh, it was yesterday?
That's my bad. But no, normally I do it for topics that I want to be slightly more careful with. And this is not a topic. Today's topic is not something that needs to be necessarily careful with. But I mean, one of the ones that I want to do coming up is, talking about like how should Christians view immigration?
Oh yeah.
As we're in Texas, very hot topic. And,
Give me a heads up on that.
So I'll give you a heads up on that one. In fact, let's just say we'll do that one next week and I'll get you notes for that one.
Yeah, let me look at my schedule, see if we...
Maybe the week after.
Yeah.
Okay. Either way. That one's a little bit more... Granted, I don't think it's super...
Had somebody ask me about that yesterday.
Well, good.
Yeah.
So that'll be... You can point them towards the podcast when it comes out. Hey, you'll get your answer, but in like a month. So just hold out.
Actually, it's funny. He called me to say he wanted to give me a heads up. That's the question he's going to ask at the upcoming Q&A.
Oh.
And I said, well, if the question is asked at the Q&A, I'll certainly tackle it then. But we can't answer every question that's submitted because we get over 100 questions. I said, so if we don't have time in the Q&A to do the question, I promise I'll take you out to lunch and kick it around, but then I can also offer them a podcast when it's available.
Yeah, well, that's probably a question. I mean, I'm sure you could answer it in 5 minutes or so, but not super thoroughly.
Yeah, there's so many ramifications and so many dimensions to it all that it. I would like the time to kind of think it all through in advance so that I can. Kind of chart out the number of different dimensions that all come to play on that one question.
Yeah. Might actually want to move your mic up a little bit from that way.
Yeah, it just is.
You have to tighten that thing so much.
I'm on camera. Maybe I can't.
It's all right. You have big forearms.
Exactly.
I don't know necessarily why you have big. It's like dad calves. You ever heard of that?
Dad calves?
Yeah. You've heard about how like dads have big calves for absolutely no reason. Granted, you have a reason because you did triathletes, but like other people who have no reason, they haven't seen a gym in 10 years and their calves are humongous.
Well, maybe at one time they had big calves and they've just kept them.
Or it's carrying around all the extra weight, one or the other. But
yeah,
you know,
that's possible.
But so it's the same for forums. But yeah, so I'll give you a better heads up for that one. And and also, if that guy who asked you the question listens to this podcast, I'm in charge of what questions get asked.
Right.
So, because I'll be hosting it. So regardless of how high up the ratio thing goes, maybe I'll just throw you under the bus there and make you answer the really hard ones. I will tell you this, the one question I probably will avoid instead and point them to either past episodes of Q&A Sunday or past podcasts of this is anything that has to do with women.
Yeah,
because it's the same thing every Q&A Sunday and it just takes up time and you've answered 1,000 times.
Right.
And you and I and Kristen had a faux debate about it.
Faux debate.
Well, because at the time I was playing devil's advocate, though now I probably actually would be devil's advocate. What? but yeah, I'll probably just avoid those questions just because I feel like it takes up time and you've answered it enough.
Yeah. Okay.
Unless you think otherwise.
Well, you're the moderator and, isn't the platform that we use for the text message, doesn't it rank?
Yeah. It allows people to upvote things.
So all I would say is if there seems to be like an unusually large number of questions about that topic, then that tells me that it's a hot topic in the room.
Yeah.
So then those are the questions I really like to answer.
Okay. Well, can do. Because it normally, if someone asks it, it normally ranks the top.
Yeah. So listeners who may be wondering what in the world we're talking about, once or twice a year at Cibolo Creek, we do a Q&A Sunday where people are given a link where they can text a question. And then I answer the questions live in the service. I have no idea what the questions are going to be in advance. And then Wyatt often serves as the moderator. He's looking at the questions while I'm answering the previous one. And that's coming up, not this Sunday, but next Sunday, which will be, what, the 14th?
Yeah, 14th. April.
And I love it. It's one of my favorite forums to share with our church family, and people really respond to it. So that, if you were wondering what in the world are we talking about, that's what we're talking.
If he gets anything wrong, I call him out on stage.
Yes,
in
exactly.
Real time. Yeah. Nope. I just ask the questions. But yeah, no, I always look forward to those Sundays. So I'm glad it's finally coming up.
Yeah.
Yeah. We should start doing it twice a year.
Yeah. In fact, last year, did we do one last year?
We did one last year, but we only did one. And I just wasn't the moderator.
It was earlier in the year, I think.
Yeah, because the date got moved around like 1,000 times.
Yeah.
I could make it and then couldn't make it, then could and then finally couldn't.
Yeah. It just seems like it's been a long time since we've done.
It does, yeah. I think we should try to do one first quarter and fourth quarter.
Yeah.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, that'd be good with me.
Yeah. Well, cool. Well, today we're going to do a topic that you've kind of been touching on a little bit in our previous. Well, I guess you're ending the series is coming soon. It doesn't matter. The time's going to be all messed up anyways. You've recently talked about the centrality of Jesus, and part of that was that the divinity of Jesus. So the idea that Jesus is God,
right,
come to earth.
Right.
And I think you've even said that a lot of people kind of, I mean, it's been a debate throughout church history since the beginning almost, I think. Right. And so... a lot of people have a difficult time grappling with that, and so I just kind of wanted to tackle it a little bit sure. In a very conversational kind of way. So, why does Jesus have to be God? And maybe, like, what is, now I know that you don't have a whole bunch of notes, but, like, what are some, like, just proofs or reasons to think that Jesus actually was God?
Yeah, there's a number of different ways to go about answering it. And one way that I probably would choose to begin with is, in some ways, this goes back to your understanding of the scriptures as divine revelation or not.
Mm.
Everybody has opinion. I believe that the Bible is a collection of writings that were inspired or governed by God in their recording. And so you look at the testimony of the scriptures, both Old and New Testament, it points to the Messiah, which is Jesus, and Jesus demonstrates the many proofs of somebody who is not simply human. So I would say that one of the reasons why I accept and why I believe that Jesus is God is because the testimony of the scriptures point to it.
So like his acts of...
not
miracle,
only his
and
acts,
then also,
but, you know, you look at Paul's writings, that he's informing the early church that God chose for the fullness of himself to dwell in Jesus. So the statements in the New Testament letters, certainly the proof from the life of Jesus as recorded in the Gospels. And then you have many indications in the prophecies of the Messiah in the Old Testament that at least demonstrate that whoever the Messiah was going to be, he was going to be a unique, unlike any other human being kind of person. And the way that he's unlike any other human being is he has character qualities and abilities that are true of divinity, a deity.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, because I immediately think of like the first chapter of John, you know, the word was with God, the word was God.
And the word was God, and then the word became flesh.
Word became flesh. Obviously, the word is, John's saying that the word, it's clear that the word is Jesus after that, within that chapter. Yeah. And I always have arguments with, I've had arguments with a Jehovah's Witness named Larry. He was like very old, super sweet guy. But anyways, they read that as the word was a God.
Yeah.
So they think that he was like almost like first among angels, but not actually God. And so, yeah.
Yeah, and I think even as compelling in John 1 is not just verse 14 making the connection that whatever the word was or whoever the word was became flesh and dwelt here on this earth. I think it's verse 18 where the language is that Jesus explained God.
Yeah.
He was an exposition of what God is like and who God is.
Mm-hmm.
So we come to know who God is in Jesus because Jesus is divine.
Yeah.
So there's just clues scattered throughout Old and New Testament that the testimony, the scriptures would give witness to Jesus being divine.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then naturally, and I'm looking forward to this coming Sunday's message where we're wrapping up the discussion about the centrality of Jesus. And we're looking at some passages in the book of Revelation. And so you have this eternal divine king sitting on a throne, and he's referred to as the Lamb, which is the common reference to Jesus, the Lamb that was slain, Jesus' crucifixion. He's worthy to receive honor and glory and power, which are things that human beings give as acts of worship to deity, to God. So Jesus is that one sitting on the throne in the book of Revelation that is receiving the worship that is due God because he's divine.
Yeah.
So again, scattered throughout the scriptures, I think there's lots of different indications. Then, specifically, I think the three biggest validations of Jesus' divinity or his deity are wrapped up in the messianic prophecies, the miracles of Christ, and then I think the miracle of all miracles, the resurrection.
Yeah.
So those are, if somebody asked me, you know, where do you come to a conclusion that Jesus is God or that he was divine? Those are the three that I'm going to spend the most time exploring as credentials for saying, name one other person in human existence who fulfilled prophecies about the Messiah. Name one other person in human existence who did these kinds of miracles that were testified and viewed by eyewitnesses that we have records of. And then certainly name me one other human being who was raised from the dead, never to die again. And you have Jesus. And what else, what other words do you use for Jesus, who is the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecies, capable of miracles that only a God could perform, and certainly the resurrection as being the three great big proofs of Jesus not being just a human.
Yeah. Yeah. And you kind of have to have all three in tandem because obviously there's people throughout all the scriptures that were able to do amazing feats.
Right.
Right. Granted, it was like God granted them the power to do it. They themselves weren't doing it.
Yeah.
But all three of those in tandem equal something more than just a God-empowered human being. I think probably one of the biggest ones, and I think this kind of comes down to it, is that you actually can't, it's actually not, I don't know if you can actually be, you know, I don't know if you can actually be a true follower of Christ without the belief that he is God, because that so much rests on that. Yeah. In that whether or not his work on the cross actually defeated death and has the power to give all of us sin. So why is it necessary for Christ to have been God?
Because I don't think that had he not been God, he could have accomplished anything on a spiritual or divine realm. And namely, the great conflict between the power of sin and the power of righteousness. So, again, if we remove the divinity or deity of Jesus out of the equation, and he's just a human being, well, then by virtue of the other witness of the scripture, then Jesus would have been a sinner. If he was just a human being, he would have received a human nature. Human nature has been tainted by sin, so Jesus would have been a sinner. And if he would have died on the cross, he would have been dying because the power of sin in his life as a human being. If he had not resurrected from the dead, then that would have demonstrated that sin was the ultimate victor. Whereas because he's deity, then not only he was sinless, he was capable of paying a price for sin that the righteous God of the universe would accept. And then his death would have been sufficient to pay for sins. And through the resurrection, he demonstrates that he has the power, that he's stronger than sin is. He's stronger than death. Death could not hold him.
Yeah.
1 Corinthians 15. So I think it's essential that Jesus is God in order for everything about forgiveness, everything about salvation, everything about eternal life to be offered to human beings. Otherwise, Jesus simply as a human being would not have had the capacity to be able to offer something to other human beings.
Yeah.
He would have been concerned with his own spiritual issues, if you would, his own spiritual predicament, just like any other human
being. Yeah, he would have been in the same boat that we are all
in. Would have, I said in my Easter Sunday message, if Christ had not resurrected from the dead, then that just leaves him back where all human beings begin. We're sinners.
Yeah.
And so his death and his resurrection are the sufficient proof of him being capable of providing for salvation, which is also the way that he's identified as being divine.
Especially for him resurrecting himself. Because, I mean, we saw him resurrect Lazarus, for instance, but Lazarus didn't do that of his own accord.
Yeah, so we see people throughout scriptures who are raised from the dead, both Old Testament and New Testament, but we don't usually get the rest of the story. The fact of the matter is that every human being who was raised from the dead through a miraculous intervention, they at another time would die.
Mm-hmm.
Lazarus was raised from the dead, but he, years later, would die. Jesus is raised from the dead. He does the raising himself and never dies again. So that, again, different resurrection.
Yeah.
And really kind of the Colossians that refers to him, the firstborn from among the dead.
Yeah.
There was no other death quite like his.
He could self-resurrect.
Yes.
Self-res, as the kids would call it.
Kids would say.
Nobody can self-res except Christ.
I'm surprised I'm not using cool words like that. I'm just a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Honestly, I'm surprised I'm using cool words like that.
Yeah, exactly. I think you're older than me, Wyatt.
I think so sometimes. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's starting to get harder for me to just get up off the ground. So.
How long have you been married now? 2 years?
Year and 4 or 5 months. So
age and marriage, it'll do that to you.
Well, I gained like 30 pounds.
Yeah, so talk to me about it.
That'll do. Granted, a lot of mine is good gain, but still.
Mine isn't.
Stop racing, this is what happens.
Exactly. Stop doing all that work.
So how do you think that just like the general confusion around the Trinity plays any role into the willingness or the unwillingness or the inability to understand Christ having been God?
Yeah. In fact, I just had a meeting this morning with a couple from our church, and they came to my office with two questions. And one of the questions, the question she had was me, she was commenting on the fact that I often referred to Jesus as God who came down to earth. And she said, I'm just trying to understand what you mean by that. And we ended up getting into a discussion about the Trinity. And, you know, this is something I see all the time. The word God is really more of a title than a name. It's a title for three divine beings sharing complete equality. So when I say God, and this was part of my discussion with this woman today, that when I say God, I'm generally operating from the assumption of understanding that that includes the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And because they're all absolutely identical in nature and character, that the Holy Spirit is as much God as the Father is, and the Father is as much God as Jesus is, and Jesus is as much God as the Spirit is. And so I think probably somewhat of a theological shorthand, I say God, assuming that everybody understands Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. It's probably a dangerous assumption, particularly in our more modern society of kind of biblical illiteracy about those kinds of things. So, yeah, I often refer to Jesus as God just in the same sentence, but recognizing that it's becoming probably a more frequent dialogue that I'm having with people is that they don't necessarily make that assumption immediately that Jesus is God.
Every time I prepare any kind of small, like whenever I prepared for my sermon last year, I kept on getting hung up on, do I need to explain these two people are the same? Yeah, and it was honestly really annoying because I'm like, I'm not going to get anywhere. Every conversation is going to get pulled back into the Trinity.
And now you know why I go overtime every Sunday. I'm always chasing the rabbits of, oh, I'm going to have to explain that.
But also this.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. And it's all, because it's all so organic and so connected that I don't care what you're talking about. There's all these other associated ideas that come to bear on our understanding of these things that I do. I find myself, well, I said that. I better explain this now. Well, that's 5 minutes. And then the next thing you know, I'm overtime. I'm having lunch with a gentleman next week. He and his wife are fairly new to our church. Not quite sure. I don't know them very well. I'm not quite sure what their, you know, spiritual history is or what their story is. But he wrote me a letter, an email a couple weeks ago and said, he was really enjoying our series on the centrality of Jesus, the topic. He said, but I'm really confused because you keep saying Jesus is God, and I don't know how to make sense of that. I've never thought of it that way. And I said, well, let's go to lunch and we'll have a discussion about it. So I'm starting to see more questions or inquiries about that distinction, probably more than I ever have.
Yeah. I know, like, because before, I think, you know, 10, 20 years ago, you could kind of assume that most people had, whether they, you know, were Catholic whenever they were younger and went out of the church or whatever their past was, kind of assumed that there was like a baseline spiritual understanding. Whether they could explain why they thought completely different story, but they thought it, right? But now, like I know for my generation, you kind of just assume that nobody knows anything about it. it is like a safe assumption, and which then again just makes it that much more difficult because you're not using the same language. And then especially yeah. like if they have like or if they go, you know, Mormons use different words. They use the same words, but they have different meanings. Jehovah's Witnesses, same words, different meaning.
Yeah.
Especially if they have any of that kind of knowledge, it makes it so much more complicated.
No, I am definitely seeing more obvious signs that we're living in a very post-Christian society. At one time, 50 years ago, while Christianity wasn't necessarily popular, it was generally understood. Like, even people who didn't practice a Christian faith, they kind of knew the story, they kind of knew some of the underpinnings of it all. That was still sort of a cultural anchor. But that's gone.
Yeah.
It's gone. So I'm probably on a learning curve right now of understanding better some of the newest limits of understanding about the Christian faith, and having to maybe change some of my language or some of my assumptions about what people understand.
Yeah, I saw this survey. It sounds like I was doing this in the prep, but I was just listening to a podcast, and this was from a couple of years ago. A survey was essentially, Jesus was a great teacher, but he wasn't God. And 43% of evangelicals agreed with it.
Of evangelicals?
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Of evangelicals. Of self-professing evangelicals. Which I thought was crazy.
Right. Yeah. So I think if you look at, I think I can say this. If you look at many of the contemporary cultural ways in which Jesus is used in advertising, in politics, in academia, it's a much bigger stretch now for the general population to understand Jesus as divine. Jesus is portrayed as, you know, the moral, religious monk of, you know, the first century. And, you know, our world right now, our nation right now, politics, celebrity, academia, if they're going to make a reference to Jesus that's positive, they're going to make a reference to his love. He's this loving human being who just had a space in his life and in his heart for everybody, and he accepted and he forgave and he embraced all sorts of people. And, but that's always explained in terms of he was a remarkable human being with a enormous capacity for love. But that diminishes his deity and the fact that he was also enormously righteous.
Yeah.
And his love isn't and wasn't the kind of love that's being, you know, propagated today as accept everybody the way they are with the things they do.
Yeah.
The typical conversation nowadays is Jesus is almost always limited to Jesus as a human being.
Yeah. 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 I think also in that same way, something that I think might have also contributed to maybe the cultural forgetting, even within the church, obviously, with that percentage I shared earlier, that Christ is also God, is kind of our watered down way of interacting with him. Like, it's become too much, and we've talked about this before, but it's become too much like Jesus is my buddy, yeah, and not enough of Jesus as God.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that our being less and less reverent towards him makes him, you know, makes it harder and harder for people to, I guess, remember that he is also God. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, we don't talk much about the fear of God nowadays. Yeah. That's very unpopular teaching. That's very insensitive sort of representation of right or versus wrong to another person. So again, go back to what I was just saying, talk a lot about the love of God, talk a lot about the forgiveness of God, talk a lot about the acceptance and the approval of God. Talk a lot about God wants you to be happy and your self-care and your self-health is the paramount thing. And we steer clear of those really difficult, hard conversations about God's truth and God's righteousness and God's judgment, God's condemnation. And so it's almost like a society ends up forgetting that dimension of God in lieu of their preference for the other.
Yeah.
And that's going to consequently, that's going to create a misunderstanding of who God is and what he's like.
Yeah. Yeah. And a forgetting of, and some of the, just the fundamental doctrines. And, cause I think you're right whenever you say that if you kind of take the God out of Jesus, you know, then that other stuff kind of goes with it. The righteousness, the justice, the, all of those things that we don't like to hear about as much. If you take the God out of Jesus, then he's just a really good dude.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so I guess let's just recap those things just so people can kind of bring it all together. So Christ is God because of your three things that you said.
I'd say four.
Or four things.
Christ is God because of the witness of the revelation of the scriptures. And again, I know that's very tenuous because not everybody recognizes the scriptures divinely inspired truth. I'm working from the assumption the scriptures divinely inspired truth, and it declares Jesus to be God in many different ways. So I'd say that's a profound reason for why I understand Jesus to be God. Then the three other big ones are his fulfillment of messianic prophecy, his miracles, and his resurrection. So we've been talking a little bit about this in our Sunday morning messages. So some of this is still kind of fresh in my mind. But if you take the messianic prophecies, specifically, there's about 334 statements in the Old Testament related to the future Messiah. Then some people break that down and say there was like 60 major prophecies of the 330, 60 major prophecies about where he would be born and the events surrounding his birth and his life and major things. And then 270 smaller fragments of statements and comments and allusions to who the Messiah would be. And most of those prophecies centered around like books, the prophecy of like Isaiah and Jeremiah. And the dating of those particular prophecies in relationship to Christ's birth is a gap of like 800 years. So 800 years before Jesus is born, Isaiah is making these prophetic predictions about a Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
So we look at 800 years later, Jesus starts ticking off in his life, in his birth, in his lineage, all these different qualifiers. 800 years later, Jesus starts ticking off hundreds of these prophecies.
And the writers of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, actually go out of their way to highlight.
Yeah, they're highlighting.
So a lot of the information here, like, why is this listed? It's because it's a reference back to people who would have known the prophecies in the Old Testament.
Right. And so, and I shared with this, I don't have the exact number with me, but years ago, a mathematician, a professor, did a study of what are the likelihoods or what's the law of probability that one person in history could fulfill these many predictions. And he ends up creating this number, or demonstrating this number, that if Jesus fulfilled just 8 of those prophecies, the probabilities of that are just astronomical. I mean, it's just an incredible number. And so that's something. Does that prove that Jesus is divine? Well, it proves that you need to wrestle with the unique nature of Jesus.
Yeah.
And the likelihood that he, of all people in history, could fulfill this many prophetic statements. So, again, I guess maybe for the really, you know, diehard skeptic or cynic about all this, I'd say, okay, if you're not willing to say it doesn't prove that he's divine, it at least insists that you wrestle with, what does it mean?
Yeah.
Like, it at least puts him in a category of human being that's completely different than any other human being in history. So then what are we talking about? So then you look at the miracles, and, you know, I think it's fascinating. I think all of the miracles have spiritual parallels to them. You know, he heals blind people because spiritually we are blind. He heals deaf people because spiritually we are deaf. He heals lepers because spiritually we are lepers, contaminated by the work and force of sin in our life. Over and over again, all these miracles have literal fulfillment. He was healing blind people and deaf people and lame people, but they all have spiritual overtones to them. And then I love it in the book of John. John in chapter 20, he's wrapping up his account of the life of Christ. And he says, I think it's like verses 30 and 31. He says, many other signs Jesus did than those that I recorded.
Yeah.
And there's a discussion, did he record 10 or 12 or 15? But he records these miracles, 10 or 11 miracles. And he says, but I recorded these so that you might believe that Jesus of Nazareth is the Messiah.
Yeah.
And in believing in him as Messiah, you may have life, eternal life, in the name of Jesus. And so you look at all the miracles, and again, the skeptic might say, I don't know that that proves he's God. And I go, okay, but you're wrestling there. You're struggling there, because who else is capable of causing the wind and the waves to stop doing what wind and waves do? Who else can give immediate sight to a blind person? Who else can take water in jugs and turn it into wine immediately, and it's the best wine at the wedding? Like, we all know how wine works, and it doesn't become that overnight. It takes years of fermentation. So Jesus is doing things where he's intervening in the natural laws of nature in all these miracles. Who else does that?
Yeah.
Who else, by definition, is capable of that? Well, I don't know of any other answer than God. Not some amazing scientist. Only God can do that sort of immediate, miraculous, supernatural sort of intervention in the laws of nature. So you look at the miracles and you go, okay, that causes you to ask the question, is this? And I think it's 2 or 3 times in the Gospels, Jesus is doing something, and I'm thinking specifically of one where he's in a boat with his disciples, and that it's, you know, this enormous storm, and these experienced fishermen are in the boat and they're scared. So it's got to be a pretty good storm.
Yeah.
That experienced boat people are afraid. And Jesus is asleep in the boat, and they wake him up like, don't you care that we're going to die in the storm? And Jesus speaks to the wind and the waves, and it becomes like glass. And I love their question. Who is this that the wind and the waves obey him.
Yeah.
I think that's the classic question of wrestling with who Jesus is. Who is this that the wind, which nobody even knows how to predict and nobody can see, nobody can control, who is this the wind obeys him, and who is it that can make a lake, a sea, become like glass in a moment's notice? Not like, let's wait 9 hours for the wind to die down. He like does it instantaneously. So then it causes you to ask the question, okay, so who is this guy?
Yeah.
And well, the only honest answer is that he's something other than simply human.
Yeah.
And then that gives its hand to the assumption, the conclusion that, well, he's divine. He is capable of doing the things that we associate only God can do. And then you look at the resurrection, and I think of the resurrection as the ultimate miracle.
Mm-hmm.
And I also, I see a connection of the resurrection as the ultimate prophecy.
Mm.
You know, messianic prophecy talked about the arrival of Messiah, the birth of the Messiah, the arrival of the Messiah. It talks about the suffering and the death of the Messiah, and it talks about him living again, prospering again, coming to power again. And so I think the resurrection is the ultimate both prophecy and the miracle. And again, how many people do you know that can raise themselves from the dead? So again, in the heart of the cynic who goes, well, I don't know if that proves he's divine. I'm like, okay, but at least demands that you wrestle with, how do you explain who he is?
Yeah. I think too, also that his resurrection had witnesses afterwards. Like like many people saw him. And something that always helps me, I have, I guess both myself and others, some friends and family that are, you should say, conspiratorial. Okay. Some of them a little tinfoil hat. All the conspiracies I believe in have come true. So let's just put it that way.
Yes.
But I always ask them a really big question that I feel like they don't ask is motive. And so whenever I look at, say, all of these, let's just take the disciples or any of the writers of the New Testament, the motive for holding up this story and going around and preaching it, like, well, people would say, well, they wanted power and influence, and they didn't get any of those things. They didn't get money. They couldn't have women, because that went against this teaching anyways. So that didn't matter. There was nothing for them to gain. In fact, all of them died a horrendous death because of it. They got put into jail multiple times. I don't know if you've seen it, but the Babylon Bee did this funny skit of like the biggest prank the disciples ever pulled. And they're all the disciples around the fire. And they're like, all right, guys, so we're going to go take the body out of the tomb. We're going to hide it. And then we're going to tell everybody that he's still alive. And then we're going to all get brutally murdered. And it's like, oh, what?
Oh, yeah.
So the motive behind it is just for that skeptic, for that person thinking, is like, why did the early believers believe this whenever they had nothing to look forward to other than at best jail? Yeah.
No, and it comes back to, and I think later this year I'm going to do a series of messages on the nature of the scriptures, because generally the whole defense of skeptics and cynics is, well, you get all of your information from the Bible. And in their minds, the Bible is suspect. Or at worst, it's laughable. And it just demonstrates a complete ignorance about the nature of how the scriptures came to be. And so we have this Bible that's, you know, got these 66 books that we call, they're not books, but these 66 writings, you know, conveniently located inside of a, you know, leather cover. And that Bible, which most people hold, that's viewed as, well, those are just writings created by Christians who are trying to perpetuate this myth, which takes a pretty dramatic stretch of imagination that if you're honest to the datings of all those writings. Over 1,500 years, 40 different authors lived in different places of the world, never met each other, but somehow uncannily they were, uncannily, is that even a word?
Don't know, but we can make it one.
In an uncanny manner, they were able to perpetuate this conspiracy. So that's ridiculous at best. And then to really know, understand the nature of the scriptures, it really is that these four guys, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, before they were biblical authors, they were just providing people of their day an account of either what they saw or what other people saw. They were just writers who were recording a personal experience that they had with this person, Jesus. Or they talked to people who had this personal experience. So their letter, their record, their little, you know, biography that they create about Jesus, before it ever exists in a Bible, it is a document that's circulating the world at the time as a credible historical piece of information. And we have more evidence to the life of Jesus and more witnesses to the life of Jesus upon which we make our conclusions about Jesus than almost all prominent historical figures from that same time.
Yeah, by like a long shot.
Yeah, by hundreds and hundreds of documents. And so I'm really concerned about how in the world do we get, let's just start with the evangelical church. How do we get Christians to confidently understand the genuine nature of the Bible?
Yeah.
And its origins and how it was produced and how it was protected over the centuries from, you know, discrepancy. And because, yes, there's a sense to which everything that we claim is based on the witness of these records. And if you summarily dismiss those records as, you know, unintelligent, incredible, meaning lacking credibility, then everything we talk about is going to be up for grabs.
Yeah. Well, and then if you're going to do that to the Bible because of, well, they're old or whatever, like, then you also have to basically throw all history about the Roman Empire, Alexander the Great. I'm pretty sure everything that we know about Alexander the Great came from one guy, like more than 100 years after he even lived.
Yeah.
And so it's like, well, then we can't rely on anything.
Yeah.
And which, I mean, is kind of the entire postmodern argument, is that we can't really rely on anything. But it's like, well, good luck living that way. But
right.
But yeah. No, I think it'd be a great series. So yeah, I mean, and ultimately also it comes down to faith, but I really think the pinnacle of this thing is like, if salvation seems attractive to you, if being freed from your sin is something that would be good, there's only one way to do that, and it's by a perfect sacrifice, and no human being can be that perfect sacrifice. Right. So it's like, regardless of any of the other skepticism, you cannot have salvation without God dying on the cross and resurrecting of his own accord.
So, you know, last week's Easter, sir.
too close.
They did come very close to each other this year. I closed my message with a challenge regarding how people understand faith. Because I had spent the majority of the message talking about the proofs of the resurrection and Jesus's place in it. And on an Easter Sunday, you know, you've got, you know, devoted believers in the room, and you have genuine skeptics and cynics.
They're who have there. Been drugged by their family.
Yeah, they came with their wife who wanted to have an enchanting Easter Sunday with the family. And and a host of other reasons why people are there who aren't normally interested in these things. So I was taking the opportunity at the end to explain that we all have beliefs.
Yeah.
And we all think our beliefs are trustworthy. That's why we choose them. And we all then consequently think that our beliefs are correct. The ones we chose are more correct than the ones somebody else chose. That's why we chose them. That's why we trust in them. And very few people are willing to recognize that that's exactly what faith is.
Yeah.
Faith is not a religious term. It isn't a Bible or Christian term. Faith is an idea, a vocabulary word designating the idea that whatever belief you trust in, that's your faith. And so the person who goes, I don't think the Bible is a credible source of divine revelation. Okay, that's your faith. You don't believe the Bible. I don't believe that God exists. Okay, that's your faith. God does not exist. I don't believe that Jesus was divine. Okay, that's your faith. And I was explaining that all of us, I don't care who you are, we all assume the risk of the faith we choose. And an agnostic, he assumes the risk of the faith he chose. An atheist assumes the risk. A Muslim assumes the risk. A Buddhist assumes the risk. The most anti-God, anti-Christian, anti-everything person, that they have beliefs about what's right and true, and they trust them, and that's their faith, and they assume the risk.
Mm-hmm.
And there's going to be a dimension of the discussion about Jesus and his divinity or his deity that a person has to make a choice about what they believe, and then they assume the risk.
Yep.
And this may sound really kind of snarky or insensitive, but don't come crying to me when you stand face to face with Jesus of Nazareth in eternity, who you discover now was as divine as it gets. He's God. And now you stand before him as your judge, and it gets really serious from here. But you assumed that risk. You told me I was an idiot because I believed it. You dismissed it, and you paid no attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I assumed the risk of being the stupid guy who believed this myth.
Yeah.
Well, someday the shoe will be on the other foot, in my understanding. And you'll stand before Jesus of Nazareth, and you'll find out, oh, you were God. Oh, you did those miracles. Oh, you were the fulfillment of that prophecy. Oh, you did rise from the dead. And you assumed the risk that that was all true. And now here you stand before it, and it's too late. And that's, I mean, that's really, as a pastor, as a preacher, that's where my heart's just so heavy these days, is trying my best in this really, you know, crazy culture that we're living in, is how do I explain these things with the proper compassion coupled with the proper passion or intensity, to try to get people to, you know, at least be honest to the issues.
Yeah.
And I'm finding it's getting harder and harder to make the case and have anybody even listen to you.
Yeah. Interesting. We shall see how it goes. It's interesting. You know, different groups are starting to seem more religious, or at least more open to being religious. So there might be, you know, I mean, depending on your view of the end times, it's all kind of going a slow, gradual downhill.
Yeah.
But, you know, and there's reason to have hope to things.
Even if there's, you know, for, you know, ever since I was a third grade, I've been around Christian circles. And ever since the third grade, Christian circles have been talking about, you know, a revival. And I'll just say, yeah, would I love to see a revival in America? Absolutely. I mean, why wouldn't I want to see a revival? But I'm going to also say, even if there was a dramatic revival in the United States, it's still headed on a downward slope.
Yeah.
Because of the nature of what God has revealed to us about the future of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So there may be a temporary blip of kind of spiritual renewal, but it's not going to save the nation. It's not going to save us from the redemptive game plan that God is currently at work fulfilling.
Yep. Follow Christ and you won't have to worry about it.
That's a short way to say that.
We hope you enjoyed this presentation of Cibolo Creek Community Church. If you did, please consider supporting the ministry of our church. Your donations make a difference. To check out more resources or to share a gift, please visit us at cibolocreek.com. Thanks for listening.